This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we're joined by noted scholar Lawrence Lessig. His new book, just out now, is called Fidelity and Constraint: How the Supreme Court Has Read the American Constitution. One reviewer says, packed with insights about the Supreme Court's history and novel readings of famous cases, this book is as brilliant as it is engaging. We talk with Lenore Scanese, founder of the Free Range Kids Movement. We'll talk about recent legislation in some states and the work of the nonprofit Let Grow. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. The U.S. Constitution is the oldest written constitution in the world. Its interpreters are faced with the challenge of how, over time, to read a document that's not only old, but also quite inflexible. In his new book, Fidelity and Constraint, by Oxford University Press, Lawrence Lessig, one of the nation's leading legal minds, explains that a fundamental approach to interpreting the Constitution is a process he calls translation. The book is just out and has received rave reviews. Cass Sunstein from Harvard Law School writes, quote, "A magnificent achievement and one of the best books ever written about American constitutional law." Lessig offers a brilliant, sympathetic account of the full sweep of constitutional history from the founding era to the modern era. Transcending political debates, he argues that the Supreme Court has been faithful to the Constitution's original meaning, while also vindicating new understandings of both liberty and equality, a book for the ages. We're delighted to be joined today by Lawrence Lessig, the Roy L. Furman Professor of Law and Leadership at Harvard Law School. Before rejoining the Harvard faculty, Lessig was a professor at Stanford Law School, where he founded its Center for Internet and Society. He also founded Creative Commons and serves on the board of the AXA Research Fund and on advisory boards of Creative Commons and the Sunlight Foundation. Lessig was named one of Scientific American's top 50 visionaries. Larry Lessig, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
First, congratulations on what many are calling a groundbreaking book and theory on constitutional law, Fidelity and Constraint. I understand you've been thinking about these ideas for at least two decades. I read your Law Review article from 1997. You had a chapter in Code and Other Laws of Cyberspace on it. To what extent, if any, did the current events in the nation and public perception of the court as being politicized factor into the timing of the publication?
Great question. You know, part of me was just feeling like if I didn't finish this, I would never finish it. So I just really set myself to get the project done. I felt like I'd thought about it and thought about how to complement the earlier work for long enough, and so I needed to just finish it. But another part of me actually did fear that the basic argument of the book might be overthrown by a committed court that was keen to advance what was perceived to be political views. So, you know, I didn't imagine that I could affect that decision by the court, so it's not like I'm writing this to save the court from itself. But I did think that it would be useful to at least mark, before that change happened, a moment in which it was possible to look back on the history of our court and see comparable efforts at fidelity from both the right and the left, and comparable constraints on those efforts of fidelity that might give us hope for an institution that wasn't inherently, or at least perceived to be inherently, political. And so, yes, I feel like this moment was a moment to get it out before it just all seemed irrelevant.
Why do conflicts over constitutional meaning arise repeatedly over time?
Well, we are trapped by an unamendable constitution, and we are blessed by a tradition that reveres that founding document. Now, there's much to be troubled about in that founding document and that tradition. But it just is the case that we have inherited a political tradition that says our Constitution is critical and important, and so we need to figure out how to live with it. Now, most other nations, when they have a problem with the Constitution, are able to step in and fix it by amending it. We don't have that capacity anymore. The amending rules are so severe and so strict, and in particular, amendments that would undermine the existing institutions or the power of people in the existing institutions are almost inconceivable. That, you know, we have to learn how to deal with this written text that's not going to be changed. And I think that motivates much of the search for methods of interpretation that can try to keep faith in light of changing contexts and still do something sensible with the underlying document.
Larry, you argue for a certain conception of fidelity, a practice you call translation. Please talk about translation. As I understand it, in contrast with originalism, what the framers would have done, is translation finding a current reading of the Constitution that preserves its original meaning in the present context?
Yeah, I think that the contrast that I want to draw is between what I call one-step fidelity or one-step originalism and two-step fidelity or two-step originalism. And so one-step fidelity says, let's go back to 1791 and ask the question, what do we think, you know, the leading authors of the Constitution or the ratifiers of the Constitution, depending on which side of the debate you want to fall, would have done in answering the question we give them. So is death by lethal injection a cruel and unusual punishment? And then you answer the question according to then you ask them the question, they answer it, yes or no, and then you take that answer and you bring it back to the present. You know, James Madison would have said yes, so therefore it's unconstitutional. The second way of approaching it is to say, let's go back and understand what they wrote and why they wrote it and what the context was in which they wrote it. Like, what was the meaning of their words at the time? And then let's carry those over to the present time, translating them in light of the current political and cultural and legal context to give them as much consistency over time as possible. Now, I'm very clear that I'm not sure it is always possible, as much consistency as possible may not be a lot of consistency, but the effort is to preserve something from the past in the present. And the mode of preservation is a familiar one when you think of the, you know, the technique of translation that we see exercised, practiced all around us. And so that answer could be very different, because what drives the answer to the extent it hangs on what's in the context could be very different, and that context therefore would yield a different answer to the same question because of the translation across these contexts.
Now, talk a bit, if you will, about fidelity to role. In one part of the book you mention, and I call it the standard of how much of a nut do I want to be seen to be by the justices. What role does fidelity to role play?
Well, so what I learned, or what I, you know, what I've come to think of as the fundamental lesson of constitutions across time is how vulnerable they are to what we take for granted in the current context. How vulnerable they are to what every normal person would think. Now, of course, you know, not everything in the current context can be described as what every normal person would think. There's lots that's very fundamentally contested in the current context. Like, is a woman's right to choose to terminate a pregnancy, you know, morally justified or not? That's a deeply contested question. There are people of good faith on both sides. But other questions, you know, like, for example, whether the law should discriminate against you on the basis of your sex, even though that's not written in the Constitution anywhere, is pretty absolutely uncontested in our current context. And so what I wanted to develop is a sense of interpretation that takes seriously the sense in which the context can constrain what is a plausible or possible interpretation of the Constitution. And that constraint I express in this idea of fidelity to role. And the idea is, in the institution of the Supreme Court, the practice of interpretation includes the practice of preserving the institution in the current political democratic context. And so their first fidelity, I think, should be to the meaning of the Constitution. But they do that subject to the constraints of this political and legal context. And the constraints might be imagined. They might be, I'm not saying that every time the court has behaved in this way, it's behaved properly in this way. But I think the history I've tried to pull together demonstrates that overwhelmingly and repeatedly, the most interesting deviations or developments in the history of the court can be understood as responses to this kind of contextual constraint. And we should understand it then as a part of how constitutions are interpreted, and then ask ourselves the question whether this kind of method is one that we would like to endorse.
Are the justices conscious of this process of translation?
Well, you know, what you learn when you get to know the justices is they're very different people. You know, some are pretty oblivious and some are incredibly astute. You know, I've not had this conversation with, for example, Justice Souter, but I imagine that if I, you know, the conversation about my book or what the theory is, but I imagine if I sat down with Justice Souter and had the conversation of the and laid out the argument of the book, it would be familiar to him in the sense that this is something that he would have been thinking about at the time that he was making some of the most important decisions he made as a justice. And I point to one in the book, which was fundamental, which was the moment in 1992 when the Supreme Court turned away from overturning Roe versus Wade, and this joint opinion by Souter, O'Connor, and Kennedy, basically explicitly said, look, we can't do this as an institution, because if we do this in the face of political fire, we will be seen to be nothing more than the kind of tool of the president. And that's not possible for our institution, and so therefore we back away from it. So I think some of them are aware of it, but some of what I'm describing here operates so subconsciously that they're not even aware of how they've taken it on. So I have great, enormous respect for my former boss, Justice Scalia, and I especially had respect when I clerked for him for the many times when he could be led to do something that was inconsistent with his politics, but consistent with his judicial philosophy. So I thought, at the time at least I was clerking for him, he had integrity as a judge because of that. But as I emphasize in the book, there are examples of Scalia's jurisprudence that are really hard to compare to what he's most known for fundamentally. So he's known as an originalist, where he says we need to read the Constitution as the framers would have read it. But there are other parts of Scalia's jurisprudence, like when he talks about theories of law, where he's totally happy to be a modernist about theories of law. And, you know, the proper question that should have been asked to him, and I never had the chance to ask him this question, was, why can you be a modernist with respect to theories of law, but an originalist with respect to whether women are protected under the 14th Amendment, right? Because why shouldn't you say, look, we need to read the Constitution according to the values of the framers and their theory of law. And the theory of law the framers had is as much binding on us as their values. But of course, he never did that. And part of my effort in the book is to demonstrate that that is a very important tell to how we should actually understand the development of fidelity across time and recognize which kinds of changes need to be reckoned and accounted for and endorsed, and which kinds of changes are actually within the commitment of fidelity to meaning.
Two cases stood out to me that I wanted to briefly touch on. Olmstead v. United States and the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act case. In Olmstead, Chief Justice William Howard Taft held that life on the telephone was not private. Can you talk about Justice Brandeis's dissent and its importance?
Yeah, so Taft was being a pure one-step originalist. He said, you know, the Fourth Amendment protects against trespass. When they tap your phones, they're not trespassing, so therefore there's no Fourth Amendment problem when they tap your phones. And Justice Brandeis said, look, we need to read the Constitution in the context in which it was written and understand the values that it was protecting. And once we understand that, then we need to, as I describe it, translate those values, given the changing technical context that we now live in. So, yes, it's not technically a trespass to tap somebody's phone. But still, phone calls are among the most private of intimate communications, and we ought to develop the doctrine to be able to protect those. And if we don't, then the Constitution over time just loses its significance or its meaning, and that's contrary, Brandeis thought, to the objective of the court, which was to preserve the meaning of the Constitution. And I think I kind of look at that as almost a paradigm case, because it's hard for anybody today to really endorse the idea that the only space that we ought to worry about the government invading is spaces where the government invades by trespassing on our property. Look, most people don't even have property that would be protected in exactly that sense. So I think that once you see the move Brandeis is making there, then that kind of that inspired me to think about what's in that move and why does it make sense there and where else does it make sense.
In the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare case, you wrote that, quote, the real genius of Roberts' opinion was not the crafting of this tool, and you were referring to cabin federal power in a context in which the framers' original device of interstate versus intrastate commerce didn't work, but the way he protected the cool in its crib. You said he was revealing a deep and intuitive sense of fidelity to role. He upheld the law under the taxing power and not the commerce authority. Briefly talk about that, if you will.
Yeah, so I see Justice Roberts as committed to the originalist ideal of federalism and trying to translate federalism into the current context given the expansion of interstate commercial activity. So he's seeking tools that will enable him to do that. And the part of his opinion that's about the Commerce Clause, basically announces a new rule for limiting the scope of federal power that had never been articulated before and kind of amazingly emerges quite cleanly from at least the scope of the doctrine that he points to. So that was a really ingenious translation. But what he did was protect that translation from the obvious political consequence that would flow from declaring Obamacare dead, because obviously it would have been perceived in a deeply political way, in a very partisan context against a president who had identified this as a signature piece of legislation. So he protected it by upholding it in the context of the taxing power. Now, you know, someone could have said, well, should it have been upheld under the taxing power? And my view is yes, under the taxing power it should have been upheld. But the question is not whether it should have been upheld under the taxing power. The question is, why did Roberts also need to write the commerce power part of the opinion? Like, why doesn't you just uphold it under the taxing power and uphold the law? And the point is, by doing both, he can achieve both the objective of further articulating a doctrine for federalism, but protect that doctrine against the consequences of political resistance in just the way that Chief Justice Marshall, way back in the days of Marbury versus Madison, announced a doctrine of judicial review that also protected that doctrine against political resistance. So I saw a parallel there that I'm sure Justice Roberts was quite aware of, and I think, you know, evinces his sensibility as a Chief Justice in his role as a defender of the institution as much as defender of particular policies or particular judicial ideas that are important to that Constitution.
Larry, you are known for your pioneering work in cyberspace-related issues. You founded Creative Commons in 2001. You founded the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford University. Let's talk briefly about translation in terms of justices who do not understand how modern technology is used. And I wanted to reference the case Riley v. California, where Chief Justice Roberts assumed that having two cell phones on one's person made one a drug dealer, and he asked one of the lawyers, what is your authority? for the statement that many people have multiple cell phones on their person. And I've been interested in the case of Ross Ulbricht, the Silk Road website, Jeremy Hammond, cases in which I feel that judges do not have an understanding of how dramatically technology has changed our lives and how it's being used in reality versus theory. What do you say about the issue of translation in something like this?
Yeah, I remember when I read that line, I thought, geez, I didn't know I knew so many drug dealers. Because obviously, you know, there's so many people who have work phones and they have personal phones and they keep them both. And it was so astonishing. Yeah, I mean, you know, this is an insight that should drive justices to humility. And, you know, some of them evince that virtue quite well and others don't. But it's also, what's really interesting, I think, about the institution of the Supreme Court is how much it relies on clerks. And I don't mean in the, you know, the negative sense of, you know, how much work do clerks do and people are critical because they think clerks do too much work. But just in the sense that justices are surrounded by contemporaries of the current, you know, cultural moment. And those contemporaries, if they have courage, stand up to the justices and try to get them to recognize just how out of step they happen to be. And I think the best evidence of that is actually, I haven't seen this study, but it would be a wonderful study to do, the evolution of pronouns on the Supreme Court opinions. Because it's astonishing to see even conservative justices who, you know, otherwise would not be so enamored of concerns about sexual equality and whether the 14th Amendment applies to women or whatever, still very sensitive to how they use or develop pronouns in a way that evinces a sensibility of their clerks more than a sensibility of the justices. And that dynamic, I think, happens a lot. There are famous examples where it didn't happen. So when the court decided Bowers versus Hardwick, that case that upheld prosecutions for homosexual sodomy, Justice Powell famously, you know, the story is he famously told his clerks, I don't think I've ever met a homosexual in my life. And one of his clerks was homosexual, but didn't have the courage to tell Powell that he was homosexual. Right. So there's an example of the failure of that communication. But I'm sure that when the Chief Justice went back to his chambers, all of his clerks sat down with him and said, what are you talking about? This is so completely obvious. So that part of the institution, I think, is enormously valuable. If we imagine those justices living for life tenure with permanent clerks who are, like, you know, equally aged and disconnected, it would be an even more dangerous institution than I think it actually is.
On a personal note, what was it like clerking for Justice Scalia? Did it change your way of thinking?
It certainly affected my way of thinking. I had the best possible clerkships. I clerked for Judge Posner, and then I clerked for Justice Scalia. And Posner on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals genuinely loved disagreement. I mean, you know, he did all of his own work. He wrote his own opinions. And the only thing he used clerks for was to argue with him. And the more fierce you were in arguing with him, the more he loved it. And so that created a certain climate that seemed to me the best possible climate. Now, Scalia hired me as his token liberal clerk. And so I respected him for that. And he wanted me to argue with him, and that was my job, and I did that as vigorously as I could when I thought it was appropriate, especially when I thought he was being inconsistent with his own theories. He didn't like the argument as much. So it was this weird experience of knowing this is my job, even though he's not responding with, geez, thank you for disagreeing with me.
Right.
He's more responding with, get out of my office. I've heard enough. That's it. That's finished. But, you know, he was an incredibly loving, pleasant man, whatever you think of his jurisprudence. And, you know, all the way until the very last time I saw him, I had lunch with him just months before he died. He was, you know, incredibly generous and eager to, you know you and your family and what was going on in your life, and you know, it was a blessing to have had the opportunity to clerk with him, however much I disagree with, you know, particular things that he did as or judgments he had as a judge.
In our remaining minutes, I have two questions. One is involving the future of constitutional law. I want to read from your conclusion you note that for so deeply have we allowed partisan norms to infect the institution of the judiciary that we don't even recognize the essentially nonpartisan character of its past. And you go into a great detail in your book about that. I found hope in your final words when you say, when we can no longer locate the pulse of principled constitutional change in a court, maybe we will again find it in the people. Larry, what do you say to a constitutional class who asks you about the future of our constitutional tradition?
I do increasingly think that we have to take up the responsibility of breathing life into our principles of constitutional law through democratic processes rather than just through courts. I think for too long, we've kind of outsourced the project of defending principles of constitutionalism to, you know, the judiciary and in particular to nine justices. And the consequence of that is that they are increasingly remote from the people. You know, Tocqueville describes how when he traveled through the United States, he said, I could never fail to meet someone who could articulate for me the precise distinction between the scope of the federal government's power and the scope of the state's power and how the two interact and what happens when they conflict. I'm not even sure that most law professors could do that today. And I think that what that means is that we've allowed the Constitution to become professionalized and held by an elite. And I vigorously oppose the idea that that is its proper place. I want the Constitution, the principles of constitutionalism, to become as deeply felt by the people as they are understood by a court. And so I think that means we've got to start making it vital again, like what these values are, and spreading them in a way that makes them more solidly supported in our democracy, as well as in the court. And you know, maybe that's the good that comes out of the dark night that we are entering right now.
With everything else that you're involved in, this book represents, I imagine, a very large part of your thinking and your life over the past 20 or so years. How does it feel to have it finally in print and so wonderfully reviewed so far?
I'm, you know, just like a parent sending his kid off to college. You know, it's a hard thing. I loved living with this book. I love thinking about it, teaching the classes, you know, and reflecting as I taught the classes. And I know that letting it go, there are a million things I didn't consider and a million points I didn't add. And so that, you know, I think all of us have this mixed feeling about the things we've created and let go. This has taken on a greater significance just because I've let it stew for so long, I think. And, you know, right now what I hope is just that it sparks conversation and reflection, and that some others can see some pattern that I think I've seen. And if that begins a conversation around that frame, then you know, I think that's the most that one can hope for as a scholar.
Larry Lessig, it's truly been an honor to have you on Law and Disorder, and we wish you the best of luck with this incredible book and with all of your endeavors.
Thank you so much for this conversation.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
You may have heard about the shaming of parents who let their son or daughter walk to school by themselves or ride public transportation alone. They're often ridiculed on social media and cast as neglectful. But in some instances, the consequences have gone beyond public shaming. In 2015, for example, parents in Silver Spring, Maryland made national headlines. They were investigated for child neglect for letting their children, ages 6 and 10, walk home from a park by themselves. In another case, Lenore Skenazy, a former New York Daily News columnist, was called America's worst mom after writing a column in 2008 about why she let her 9-year-old son ride the subway alone. Last year, Utah passed a law making it not a crime for parents to let their children play in a park without supervision or walk home alone from school. This is hopeful news for our guest, Lenore Scanese, who has been advocating for so-called free-range parenting laws for several years. We're joined today by Lenore Scanese, president of Let Grow, a nonprofit promoting childhood independence and resilience, and founder of the Free Range Kids Movement. Lenore is also a speaker, blogger, syndicated columnist, author, and reality show host. Lenore Scanese, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks. I hope I'm disorderly enough.
Oh, that's a requirement. In 2008, your son begged you and your husband to let him take the subway home alone. You handed him a map, a Metro card, quarters for the phone, and $20 for emergencies. He got on the subway at Bloomingdale's on your local line.
Mm-hmm.
You believed he'd be safe and that he could figure his way home. 45 minutes later, he arrived home ecstatic with independence. When you wrote a column about this, what kind of response did you think you'd get?
Well, I've been a columnist for so long, I expect to get like five letters and then go on to the next column. That's generally what it was. But that night, as I handed in the column, one of the editors came over and started talking to me about his own son and what age he was going to let his kids do things. And I thought, gee, that guy never talks to me. So I thought, oh, maybe it's a little more popular than my other columns. But that was it. I mean, I just figured another one bites the dust.
But what in fact happened?
Oh, my God. Life-changing. 2 days after it ran, I ended up on the Today Show, MSNBC, Fox News, and, for contrast, NPR, defending myself and my decision to let my son go. And it just became sort of a flashpoint for people to talk about when did things change and why is she letting her son do this and is it good or bad and is it irresponsible or very responsible to let your kids do something. And it just became the story that I'm talking about to this day. That son is 21. So it became a bigger deal than I ever expected, obviously.
Why are parents and so many others fearful of letting their children have an experience like your son's?
I'll go back to that time, just when I was first being interviewed on all these shows. You know, there'd be sort of some preliminary back and forth thing, kind of fun, you know, and sometimes my son Izzy was with me and it's like, oh, did you have fun? And, you know, is it scary? Blah, blah, blah. But at some point, in almost every interview for the first 4 or 5 years, the interviewer's voice would drop and they would look at me like I'm looking at you right now, very sincerely. And they would say, but Lenore, how would you have felt if he never came home? I'm like, bummed, confused, disappointed, worried. How would I feel? And anybody knows how you'd feel. And I realized the reason there was no good answer is because it literally wasn't a question. Since they knew how I would feel, why were they asking it? And gradually I came to realize they were asking it because that had been my crime. My crime had been not going to that darkest place where something terrible, however unlikely, could have happened, and it would all be on me, and I'd be guilty, and I'd be living with this remorse and regret and self-hate and whatever for the rest of my life. And why hadn't I thought that way first and therefore decided not to let him do anything? Because to be a good parent in America is to always, I call it worst first thinking, come up with the worst case scenario first, and you proceed as if it's likely to happen. And if you don't think that way, you're thinking wrong.
So you launched a blog called Free Range Kids. Great term. What does it mean?
Oh, 12 years later, you'd think I'd have a succinct answer. Basically, the premise that I put on there the very first weekend, which I started it right after the subway ride, was that our kids are not in constant danger, and yet we act as if they are, and sometimes we're forced to pretend they are. And so this was just my cry to say, you know, our kids are not dumber than we were. They're not less safe than we were. The crime rate is at a 50-year low now. I would think, you know, if anybody would know it, it would be this audience. And yet we are supposed to protect them as if they all need, a security detail every time they leave the house. So it was really a let's take a look at our culture and decide how did we become so afraid and do we have to parent that way?
Do you think the Eitan Potts case here in New York informed some of these reactions.
If your listeners could see me, all I'm doing is nodding up and down. Eitan Peetz was, you know, obviously it's a tragedy. It was a young boy, 6 years old. He walks to the bus stop, 1979, and he's never seen again. And he becomes the first picture on a milk carton. And the milk cartons, the milk carton pictures, for anyone who doesn't know, started coming out in like the mid-80s, around 1984. And they were pictures of children who were missing, and they said, "Have you seen me?" And so a generation of parents grew up as kids looking at the face of a child that was about their age who was never seen again. And what I consider the height of irresponsibility is that the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, which put these pictures on the milk cartons, that's not the irresponsible part. The irresponsible part is not saying that the vast majority were taken in custodial disputes or were runaways. And so the impression you got, you know, Rice Krispie bowl after Rice Krispie bowl, was that all these children had been snatched off the streets by strangers. And that begins the campaign about stranger danger, which pointed us in the exact wrong direction when it comes to child safety. The vast majority of crimes against kids, whether beating or sexual, are committed by people they know.
What is a helicopter parent?
First of all, not my term. I did free-range kids, but I didn't do helicopter parent. Helicopter parent is a term that became popular, I think, in the 90s and then beyond, although now it's sort of phasing out to snowplow parent, which we can also talk, is somebody who hovers over their kids all the time. And people think that I'm the anti-helicopter parent lady. I am the anti-helicopter culture lady, because nowadays, if you want to let your kids have some freedom, you know, to walk to the park, to play outside, there are so many, to walk home from the bus stop, there are so many cultural norms and even laws that prevent it, and regulations. We heard from a person in Kentucky recently, we being Let Grow, which is the Free Range Kids grew into a nonprofit about a year and a half ago called Let Grow. Not Let It Grow, not Let's Go. It's Let Grow, G-R-O-W. Anyway, so people are writing to me at Let Grow, writing to the site, letgrow.org. And her son, who was nine, I think, was only allowed to get off the bus from the bus, you know, from the school bus, if there was an adult there to walk him home. And they were allowed three grace times. So one time, her grandfather, who was the guy in charge of picking the kid up, was in the bathroom when the bus came. So that's strike one. Strike two, the kid was supposed to stay after school one day, but instead, he didn't know that, and he got on the bus. So he got off the bus, and grandpa wasn't there. Well, by the time there's strike three, the bus always has to take the kid directly to the bus depot, which sounds like the least safe place you could bring a kid, as opposed to the bus stop, which is a couple houses from where he lives. But anyway, strike three, and they call Child Protective Services on you. So she was going, what can I do? And, you know, I hear from people around the country who are, what am I supposed to do, quit my job? Rhode Island wanted to pass a law, tried to pass a law, that no child under seventh grade would be allowed to get off the bus without an adult there to walk them home. And that goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning. If you can fantasize a horrible scenario where the child is hurt, you know, the worst first thinking, then you can justify any kind of excessive supervision that either the state demands or the state does, or that's imposed upon parents. So suddenly, like, what if you work two jobs? What if you work one job? What if you're a single mom and you work a job? You can't be there to pick up the kid. You can't afford a babysitter. And suddenly, you're doing something that the state says is taboo, or the school.
How does this differ from, say, 40 or 50 years ago? Let's take a step back down memory lane.
Let's take a step down my memory lane. Well, I'll tell you, when I was a kid, my mom let me walk to school at age 5, and that was the norm. She wasn't...
Were you in a city?
I was in the suburbs. I was in the suburbs of Chicago. But what she didn't have to do back then, and this is what I feel bad for parents, but I also want to try to figure out how to change it, is my mom didn't sit there, oh, if I let her go, what about, what if she's like Elizabeth Smart? What about Eitan? What about Adam Walsh? I could never forgive myself. Should I do this? No, I'll just walk her. She wasn't going through this litany of horrible stories that are so anomalous that we remember them all. They're so unusual and so scary that they sort of sear themselves on the brain. And furthermore, nobody was saying, what? You know, my mom's name was Ribsy, oddly enough. Ribsy, why are you letting I know? Now she's laughing. Okay. All right, there we go. Cat's out of the bag. First time I ever said my mom's name in an interview. Now Heidi's laughing. Anyways, but nobody said to her, how dare you let your child go? You know, how, Mrs. Scanese, how would you have felt if she never came home? Nobody was doing that to her. And weirdly, when I got to the corner that I had to cross to go to my local school, the crossing guard was 10. Right? And wearing, you know, a day glow sash, you know, with all the power that invested in him to stop whatever traffic was coming by. So not only did we trust the 5-year-olds to walk to school, we trusted the 10-year-olds to shepherd them. And one little asterisk about this story is that, this is strange, but the crossing guard, I married him.
No,
yes,
no.
I know. And all the other parents are going, that's what we're afraid of. You know. But he was not 30 at the time. He was 10. Let's remember that. And I didn't realize we realized years after marriage that he had been my crossing guard. Anyway, so the point is somehow we trusted kids implicitly, and we trusted parents to know when their kids were ready. And we didn't second guess them, and we didn't shame them. And if something bad had happened, I don't think people would have pointed to my mom and said it's all her fault the way we're doing now. And so how can you not be a helicopter parent if you think that there's no support for you?
And what do you think has changed that has made this the new normal?
This is like all I think about for 12 years in a row, so I'll try to boil it down because we don't have 24 hours here. I'll give you the four short answers, like sort of in my book, that I think are real, and then the fifth weird answer, if you're game.
Yeah.
First of all, we have the media to blame. If it bleeds, it leads. There's no story that the news likes more than a white middle or upper middle class child who is kidnapped by a stranger, right? That's why we all know the same names. Two is we live in a litigious society. You start thinking like a lawyer. What could go wrong? Who would be blamed? It just sort of becomes
worst case scenario.
Yes, yep. Exactly. Worst first. I actually came up with worst first because I thought that stranger danger had part of its power from rhyming.
Right.
But worst first is not catching on. Anyways, third reason is we live in an expert culture. Experts are there to tell you you're doing it wrong. There's magazines and books all filled with stuff that you didn't realize and didn't think about. Parents Magazine had a cover story of the 10 dangerous things in your house, and number one was the laundry hamper. I mean, really, there's just a way to sort of dangerize anything. And fourth, you live in a capitalist society, which is fine, but the dollar that is easiest to get from any human is the dollar from a fearful parent. So if you can make us afraid, then you can sell us something to assuage the fear, which is why all the new apps that are telling you, you know, you can GPS your kid and you can listen in on their conversations and you can hear, you know, you can see who they're texting, and all of that starts with, we'll give you peace of mind because wouldn't it be terrible if? And it's like, you're giving us the opposite of peace of mind. You're scaring us about something that we weren't necessarily scared about. There are devices that can test your child's temperature while they're away from you. And
it's a very corporate-run model,
a
family.
It is a very corporate-run model. It is. It's like watching the product as it goes down the assembly line and making sure, you know, like you're the inspector.
Right. Yeah. And what was the fifth?
The fifth one is strange. There's a guy named Alan Levinowitz who is, I just love, he's a professor of religion at James Madison University in Virginia, and he writes about religion. And he writes about how we still, you know, it's not like there's an absence of religion, but religion covers, it used to tell us, you know, what we ate and who we could marry and what to say and what words were wrong and, you know, how to live. But there's a shrinking area that religion covers in our lives now. It has authority over a smaller area. And so then that leaves a lot of other questions like, you know, how should my kid live and how should I raise them and what's good and what's bad and what's safe enough to us to decide. And we don't think that there's like, you know, that everything is left to God's will or to fate or to, you know, to anything other than us. And when it's all on us and we have all this tech that allows us to be omniscient in a way no human being ever could be before, because we really can see. I mean, when Harry Potter was written, it was still weird to have the Marauder's map, right, where you could see where Harry and his friends were on a map. You couldn't do that as recently as Harry Potter, and now you can do it just by, you know, where's my iPhone or, you know, or GPSing your kid. So when you can know your kid's temperature and their blood oxygen level and their heart rate and who they're talking to and what they're saying and what websites they're going to and what they had for lunch and their latest grade on a quiz, all this stuff is available via app, you feel like you're God. But along with that comes the power to keep bad things from happening. And so if something bad does happen, there is no wiggle room and there is no absolution. It's all like, well, why weren't you paying attention? That kid fell in the gorilla cage.
Yes. Yep.
And half the people were saying, why wasn't she watching? She should have known. How dare anybody take their eyes off their kid for even a second? And it's like, you know, if she thought it was, if it was dangerous to go to the zoo because everybody was falling into the gorilla cage, okay. But obviously this had never happened before. That's why it's national news. That's why we remember it today. But somehow it was her fault because we're, as long as we can be omniscient, why are we not omnipotent as well? And it's driving parents crazy. The end.
Lenore, what are your thoughts on persons who repeatedly call, for example, the Department of Children and Families or the police on parents who foster early dependence in their children?
Early independence.
Independence. Right.
I think people who repeatedly call are generally ex-boyfriends who want to sick the government on their girlfriends because when the hotline was set up, the Child Protective Services hotlines in America in the 1970s, it was to protect kids, obviously. And in our zeal to do that, we made a bad law. And the bad law was that you could report anyone anonymously, and that would have to be checked out, which means that if you dumped my son and I'm the angry ex-mother-in-law, I can call Child Protective Services from now until the day you die and say, I saw this woman beating her kids, and they will have to go to the door, because if they don't go to the door and this was the time that you were beating your kids to death, that will be on them. And so anonymous calling was a big mistake, and we have to get rid of that.
And we still have that system.
We still have that system. People are trying to get rid of it. We work with a lawyer named Diane Redleaf, who's working on cases like this, like the Kentucky case when, you know, the kid has to be walked home from the bus stop, and similar cases.
Until the age of, what was it, 10?
I don't know what age it was for him. The Rhode Island law that didn't pass was up till 7th grade.
Right.
But I've heard, you know, 7, 8, 9, something like that.
In fact, my research yielded that there were only a few states that had a law of what age a child can be left home alone on a regular basis. Does that sound right to you?
That sounds totally right. It's generally like you can't leave a kid who's, too young in a situation that seems dicey. And then, I don't mind those laws. I mean, I agree with that. Mm-hmm. But then it becomes, what's the interpretation? And there was a case in New Jersey where, and car waiting cases are very controversial because people think that children die the instant they're left alone in cars. And in fact, it's a misperception. Yes, children can die in cars, waiting in cars, but they're generally forgotten there. They're not waiting there during a brief errand. And in fact, if it's an errand, children are actually safer in the car. More children die in parking lots than waiting in a car while the mom picks up the pizza or the dry cleaning. But in any event, there was a case in New Jersey where a mom let her kid, I don't know, I think he was like a 5-year-old, wait in the car, and it ended up being close to 15 minutes, possibly a little less. And she was found guilty of child neglect. And she appealed it, and it went to the appeals court
panel
in New Jersey. Yeah, thanks. And they found her guilty again, and they said, because we need not enumerate the horribles that could have attended this innocent child. And it's like, yeah, you do need to enumerate them, because if they're crazy, I don't want to be put in jail or have my child taken away or even have to attend a parenting class if you're fantasizing that a giant, you know, eagle could come and get them or that they could be kidnapped, you know, instantly in a giant parking lot with a million security cameras there. And let's talk about the likelihood of that. And if the chances are 1 in 1,000,000, does that mean that I'm irresponsible, or does that mean that you, just because you can imagine something bad happening, doesn't mean that I have to take precautions against it? Right? And so what was great is that when it finally reached the New Jersey Supreme Court, they negated those two guilty verdicts beforehand and said, we don't think that a parent has to think that way. And I thought that was a very heartening decision, because you're, as a parent, you make a million decisions on this, you know, the seat of your pants. You know, I have to, oh my God, you know, the car broke down, I have to go pick up my husband, you know, can the 7-year-old stay with the 5-year-old and watch a cartoon for 15 minutes? I'd say yes. Maybe you would say no. It's up to us. It's not up to somebody, you know, calling us in anonymously, and then maybe some 22-year-old child protective services worker saying, well, my mom never did that.
Lenore, do you have rough statistics about the impact on, say, families who are more disadvantaged?
Oh, my God, I do.
What are they?
Well, first of all, 1 in 10 children every year will be investigated by Child Protective Services.
One in 10?
1 in 10. That's like 7 million out of 70 million. Yeah. And then if you're black, what? You tell me. Do you have any idea what percentage of black children will undergo some kind of CPS investigation while they're kids?
Let's say 50%.
Very close. 53.
Wow.
Yeah. Huge. So it's like you're born under this microscope.
Wow. Let's talk in our remaining minutes about the state of the laws.
Oh,
are there a lot of laws being promulgated to kind of crack down on these?
There's very heartening news
on
the legal front, which is that last year, Utah became the first state to pass the free-range parenting law. They actually called it that. It passed unanimously, and it said that letting a kid walk home from school, play outside, wait briefly in a car under some circumstances, or come home with a latchkey will not be mistaken for neglect in the absence of something else. Of course, if it is neglect, if you're, you know, leaving the kid there and going to Hawaii, you know, that's something else. But it just pressed the pause button on that judgment. And it reverberated. I mean, it got international attention. And this year, 6 states have been considering those laws. And Texas is considering one now. Connecticut has a vote coming up. South Carolina had passed in the Senate, and their legislative window is very brief, so when they come back in January, they'll consider it in the House. 2 other states that I can't think of right now. Oh, Arkansas passed something that's like not quite a law, but it's a, I don't know, a declaration
right,
or something that
right.
was also along those same lines, because parents don't want to have to think like, wow, I got to do something. I'm a good parent. I love my kids. But right now, I'm going to let them play outside. They're driving me crazy while I get my work done here.
So playing outside, what if it's in the yard and they're alone?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, you know, first of all, most parents will never be arrested or investigated. I don't want people to get the wrong idea
right.
that it's martial law out there. Although in some ways it is. But anyways.
Yeah.
You know, most kids play out on the lawn and it's no problem. And one of the founders of Let Grow is a psychologist, psychology professor named Dr. Peter Gray, G-R-A-Y. He wrote the best book. I love it. It's called Free to Learn. And he says that kids as young as 4 can start playing outside on their own. It's not that fun. And so one of our big goals of Let Grow is to get more kids outside, because kids don't naturally just want to go outside. They want to go outside if their friends are there. And I think that's healthy, and it's good for a neighborhood. It's good for the elderly people there. It's good when there's more people trusting each other and outside and getting to know each other and playing. So most parents will never be investigated for letting their kids play outside. Once in a while, when there is a story like that, you'll read about it on our site, because it's an outrage.
I'm looking at your site, and one thing we didn't talk about is why it's detrimental to sort of overprotect children. And you say it right on the website: treating today's kids as physically and emotionally fragile is bad for their future and ours. Let Grow counters the culture of overprotection. I like that.
You do good, because we're always trying to hone that message. Right. I mean, I'm sure you've read about this, that young people today are more anxious than ever. I don't like talking about there's more suicide than ever. Maybe not than ever, but it's going up.
Up, right.
I would be anxious, too, if I'd been driven everywhere and told that there are strangers out to get me, and if my parents were watching every move I made, and if they felt they had to, because otherwise they might be deemed negligent. You know, the way you get confidence, the way you get a story to tell, the way you get the foundation that is childhood, is by making your way and making some mistakes.
Exactly.
And getting lost and climbing a tree and being scared and then climbing it again a little higher. And if all of these things are like, here, I'll get a ladder and I'll stand next to you. Here's your harness. I'm going to hoist you up to the branch. You know, that's not going to make you less anxious.
You don't develop an immune system.
Exactly. You know, exactly. The immune system is the analogy. So another one of our founders of Let Grow is Jonathan Haidt. Everyone thinks it's Jonathan Haidt, H-A-I-D-T, who co-wrote The Coddling of the American Mind. And my favorite analogy of his is that there are systems that are fragile. There are things that are fragile. You drop a wine glass on the ground, it breaks. That's personally why I hate wine glasses, but my husband likes them. Anyways, drop a wine glass, it breaks. I see you have a plastic cup. You drop your cup on the ground, nothing bad happens, nothing good happens. It remains the same. It's resilient. But there are certain systems that are anti-fragile, that actually get stronger when they are tested, when they have some kind of contention, you know, they face something. And one of them is the immune system, like you were just saying. You know, you have to be exposed to some germs to develop immunity. Otherwise, you're weaker. And two is bones supposedly grow back more strong where they're broken. And the third anti-fragile system is children. And unless they have some fights with their friends without you there, unless they get lost and find their way home, unless they lose and don't get a trophy, unless they're disappointed, confused, uncomfortable, then how do you expect them to grow? For 10 years, I was free-range kids, and I changed a lot of minds. People talked about it and thought about it and nodded along, but I didn't see behavior change. So when I started working with other people and we created Let Grow, the goal now is behavior change. And the hardest thing to do is be the one person whose behavior is changing. You can't be the only one sending your kid to the park. Whether or not, you're not going to be arrested, most likely. But even if the kid gets there, there's nobody to play with. And so he comes home or she comes home and, you know, back on the couch. So what we're trying to do is create either communities, a whole community. Wilton, Connecticut has been amazing about this, where they're having block parties and pop-up playgrounds and getting kids outside and encouraging, like, independence on Halloween.
What's the website for Let Grow?
Oh, letgrow.org, letgrow.org. And if you click on schools, there's just two initiatives. One is the Let Grow Play Club. And the other thing is the Let Grow Project. And this is the simplest, most transformative thing I've ever seen. And so if you can get your school to do it, please do. But until you see them do something without you, you don't have that evidence that you've done it. And it feels so
great. Or
that
they've individuated.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, that they're, look who they are. They're a person in the world. They're not just Velcro to you. They're not in the pouch.
Right.
Right?
An appendage.
Yes. And when all of a school is doing it together, then you see kids back outside and other parents aren't judging you because everybody's doing it. And from the schools that we've talked to, the teachers are happy. The kids are more confident. They're raising their hands. It's just a win, and it's free, and it doesn't take class time. And it's there at letgrow.org.
It sounds like a revolution, Lenore.
Yeah, I hope so.
So important. Letgrow.org. This has been wonderful, and we hope to have you on again.
Oh, my God, I'd love
as
that.
As Let Grow has more school-related projects all around the country.
Thank you. I hope to come back. This was really fun, and you hit on so many things I love to think about, so thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.